So thank you so much for all these welcoming words. I would like, first of all, to express my deep gratitude to Dimitris Vardoulakis for his invitation to give this series of lectures, and to Christopher Peterson, who accepted to be the respondent to open our discussions after each lecture. And I'm very grateful also to Joe Gelonesi for his wonderful hospitality on the air, and more generally to the University of Western Sydney for this honor that is being done to me. I would like to dedicate these three lectures to the memory of Hélène Tartar, who, as Dimitris said, was editorial director at Fordham University Press. I owe her so much, and I have so many precious memories with her in Paris, in New York, at Yale. If she were here with us, I imagine she would be knitting, surprising as it might sound. It's what she always did when she was listening to someone speak. And I think for her, it was a way to lend an ear even while she was busy with something else. It was indeed a way to listen even better precisely because she was apparently busy with something else. And I'm tempted to think of listening in general as the delicate work Hélène performed as she knotted and intertwined her threads. I had spoken of these conferences with Hélène last fall in a little restaurant in Manhattan, and I mentioned the title that I thought I would give them, The Aesthetic Supermarket. In the end, I decided not to keep that title and to exchange it for another that comes down to one word that was already mentioned, iconomy. Iconomy followed by a subtitle, The Circulation of Images. Now, iconomy is a portmanteau word in which, on the one hand, you hear icon. Acorn was one of the Greek names for the image. And, on the other hand, economy, that oikonomia that already for Aristotle designated the just and good management of exchanges. But before we get to this iconomy that will be our subject for the three lectures, I would nonetheless like to say a few words about the aesthetic supermarket that I had in mind, because its idea or its shadow will be present behind every sentence of my iconomic discourse. What would this aesthetic supermarket be? And where would it come from? What I had in mind was, of course, not some shopping mall specialized in selling cosmetic products, even though the shopping mall will be of great interest to us as the cinematic commonplace that one sees staged by directors as different as Jean-Luc Godard, Brian De Palma, or Quentin Tarantino. On the one hand, then, speaking of an aesthetic supermarket was a way of indicating that aesthesis, in other words, in Greek, sensation, sensory or sensual perception, aesthesis is indeed a market where exchanges take place. Images and sounds circulate on this market, along with forms of listening, gazes, or points of view. We will be constantly interrogating this mercantile nature of the aesthetic, of sensibility or sensationality. We will perhaps do nothing other than wonder if the sphere of aesthesis is structurally, intrinsically mercantile and swapping, or if its commodification has befallen it as it's becoming in the era of globalized capitalism. But speaking of an aesthetic supermarket also implied, on the other hand, recalling that the sensational market under investigation here might be considered as a structure superimposed over the market tout court. I am, in effect, thinking of Marx, who, in the preface to his contribution to a critique of political economy, spoke of a real foundation, reale basis, that of the economic relations of production, upon which is raised or edified a superstructure, Überbau, of which the aforementioned sphere of the aesthesis would be a part, just as the entirety of forms qualified as, I quote Marx, legal, political, religious, artistic, or philosophic. End of quote. So the sensible supermarket of our sensations would thus be a market of the senses or of sensory perceptions that is superimposed over the market tout court. And it would find itself determined and conditioned by it. I quote Marx, "The mode of production of material life," he writes, "conditions," bedingt in German, "conditions the social, political, and spiritual life process," Lebensprozess, "in general." End of quote. In other words, our way of perceiving, our way of seeing, hearing, and feeling in general, would be the reflection or the echo of underlying economic and social relations. Marx, in fact, states this very clearly early on and in an entirely explicit way in his 1844 manuscripts, when he writes that the five senses are constructed and that their forming or fabrication, Bildung, is, I quote, "a labor of the entire history of the world down to the present." Eine Arbeit der ganzen bisherigen Weltgeschichte. He takes the example of music. I quote, "It is music that first awakens the sense of music in man." End of quote. It is music, then, that forms or produces this sense of music, Marx notes, before deducing from this that the senses of man in society are senses different from those of the isolated human. And Marx concludes, I quote, "Only through the objectively unfolded richness of man's essential being, i.e., only through the transformation of the real, through the human labor that is thus deposed and objectified in it, only thus, then, is the richness of subjective human sensibility," a musical ear, an eye for beauty of form, in short, senses capable of human gratification, senses affirming themselves as essential powers of man, only thus, then, is human sensibility either cultivated, gebildet, or brought into being." End of quote. These several paragraphs from the manuscript, Marx's manuscript, do indeed say that sense organs are fabricated or shaped by life in society. Marx even goes so far as to consider that, I quote, "besides these direct organs, unmittelbaren Organen, therefore, social organs develop." Social organs bilden sich, develop or are being fabricated. End of quote. In other words, shared ways of feeling, or what we might prefer to call distributions of the sensible. I'm, of course, thinking here of Jacques Rancière's work. But what Marx also asks us to think in these pages from 1844 is that the organization of sensation, or the sensational organology, I will come back to that term later, of aesthesis, is not only determined by what he will later in 1859 call the real foundation, reale basis. It is also conditioned and modeled by the artistic or aesthetic productions that belong to the superstructure. Now, if he was able to write that music is what produces the ear, I wonder what Marx would have said of the gaze and of the film, of the cinema he didn't have time to become acquainted with. The first projection by the Lumière brothers took place 12 years after Marx's death. It is actually the cinematographic shaping of sight and of visibility that we will be interrogating here during these three lectures. We will, in effect, be speaking essentially of films over the course of these three lectures, and it is starting with cinema that we will attempt to think what I thus propose to call an iconomy, in other words, the economy of images and of their exchanges. Even if it is apparently a recent neologism, this term, iconomy, nonetheless comes from much further away than the cinema. As Giorgio Agamben has shown, it is the history of the first eras of Christianity that gave birth to what he describes as a theological-economic paradigm, whose effects can be seen, Agamben writes, I quote, in the current triumph of economy and government over every other aspect of social life, end of quote. This is from The Kingdom and the Glory. Now, a French writer and thinker, Marie-Josée Monzin, explored the consequences of this theological economic paradigm on what she calls, I quote her, the doctrine of the image that formed in the context of the Byzantine crisis of iconoclasm in the 8th and 9th centuries. In short, image and economy seem to belong to one another, and their lexicons or categories seem to be intertwined well before the birth of film. But are we so sure of this? Because cinema is not only the name of the technical apparatus that developed starting with the projections proposed by the Lumière brothers in 1895. Cinema has also become, in much of the writing devoted to it, cinema has also become the name of the world. Either in a hyperbolic version that can be attributed to Gilles Deleuze, who in his reading of Bergson's Matter and Memory speaks of the universe as a film in itself, or the universe as meta-cinema. Or, in a somewhat more limited or narrow version, that can be attributed to Jean-Luc Nancy, another French thinker, who, for his part, describes cinema as an existential, in other words, I quote him, a condition of possibility of existing. I quote from an article by Nancy that is not translated in English, I think, entitled Cinéphile et Cinémonde. In a book called Apocalypse Cinema, soon to forthcoming at Fordham University Press, I myself proposed that in order to describe the archifilmic structure of the world and of the experience of the world, we could take up and divert a famous, maybe all too famous phrase by Derrida. Derrida wrote, "There is no extra text, il n'y a pas de hors texte." And there is no extra film, I tried to argue in that context, because, what does that mean, there is no extra film? Because the real that we might want to place in opposition to cinema, to the extra film, already has the structure of film or of cinema. Now, my concern here is not to return or to try to go more deeply into these formulations and their necessity. What I merely wish to note is that there is nothing obvious about saying that the term iconomy comes to us from faraway times when cinema did not exist, for the simple reason that cinema may well be another name of existing itself. And this is why, while auscultating the economic structure of film, we will constantly be touching on what needs to be called the archi-cinematographic factory of experience. Experience always already has something filmic or cinematographic. We'll come to that later. But what then is this economy of cinema or of archi-cinema that we are getting ready to explore? It is not only, of course, a question of the cost of filmic images, of the considerable investments that some sequences demand in terms of production costs. We all have in mind, I think, during the credits or of one blockbuster or another, you know, the infinite list of names of those who labored to make the digital stills we saw go by with many special effects. And one sometimes gets the impression that one is reading the census report of a whole city, you know. So it's not only a question of the profits, neither, that one image or another may generate, for example, through product placement, or what in French is interestingly called advertising's right of asylum in films. It's not even a question of the complex ties, which are fascinating, between the movie industry, in the end a pleonastic expression maybe, between the movie industry and the worlds of finance and even the insurance or reinsurance markets. Fascinating ties. These conditions are, of course, determinant for the economy of the fabrication of cinematographic images. As Walter Benjamin has already noted in his famous 1935 text, The Work of Art in the Age of Its Technical Reproducibility, to which we will have occasion to return more than once, especially in the last of these three lectures. What will concern us, however, is something different. The goal of our inquiry is not to retrace the way cinema depends on its economic determinations in the usual and supposedly strict sense of the word, economy. It finds and takes its point of departure, this inquiry of ours, in a statement from Gilles Deleuze that interrogates filmic economy in a much more radical or structural way. Quote, money, that's what we can read in Time Image, the second of the two volumes Deleuze dedicated to cinema, money is the backside of all the images that cinema shows and edits from the front. Let me read it again. Money is the backside of all the images that cinema shows and edits from the front. Now, what does this mean? To begin to understand this sentence, we will constantly be rereading it, actually. To begin to understand it, let us turn to a first sequence that we are going to look at very closely. The fourth season of the famous television series The Sopranos opened on September 15, 2002, with a remarkable episode called For All Debts, Public and Private. This title is borrowed, if I dare say, from the sentence that figures on all American banknotes. Quote, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. At the end of the episode, in a sequence that you will see in a minute, Tony Soprano's nephew, Christopher Moltisanti, is his name, pays a visit to his mother after having avenged his father's death by assassinating the police officer who had killed him. And he's carrying on him the $20 bill that he carefully took out of the cop's wallet on his cadaver. While his mother sits down at the table, in front of the framed portrait of his deceased father, Chris remains standing in front of the kitchen refrigerator, covered with pictures, devotional images, and popular proverbs printed on a backdrop of kitsch sunsets or colorful rainbows. "Keep it simple," says one of the proverbs. "One day at a time," says another. So let's look at this sequence. I don't know if we should dim the lights or is it okay? No, it's okay. Yeah? One day at a time. It is onto this last maxim that Chris uses a magnet to stick the $20 bill he holds in his hand while we hear on the soundtrack the percussive beginning of the song that will accompany the final credits. The cowbells on the soundtrack marking the tempo almost sound like the tick-tock of a clock measuring the passing of time. And in fact, the result of the collage Chris is composing under our eyes is to isolate the word time, which finds itself opposed with the bill, as if the proverbial expression had transformed into another, eliding only the verb to be. Time is money. This is something we are tempted to translate in the context of this episode, whose title is borrowed from fiduciary money, to translate as time is debt. Time is not only money, it is also, and perhaps above all, credit. Cut, as you saw, the editing takes us back then to the seated mother. In the meantime, during the operation of exchange her son has just accomplished in his brief traffic in signs, signs that are all at once linguistic, pictorial, and monetary. In the meantime, the image of the father, the framed image of the father, has been turned around. I will show it to you again. We see the back of the frame, the dark verso of the portrait, which is now lying down with its recto against the table. Chris casts a last silent look onto his mother and leaves, while the camera draws into a close-up on the banknote, as if the image of Andrew Jackson, 7th President of the United States, had come to take the place of the overturned image of the father. Or rather, perhaps, as if the backside of the image, its other side, were money. The episode concludes with a slow and inexorable zoom on the eyes and then on the eye at the center of the bill. Let me show that again to you. Now, I would like to keep this apparently cross-eyed gaze that you saw in mind. I would like you to keep it in mind. For we will have to return a bit later on to what is squinting like this, to what seems awry in what we might call the fiduciary image. The image and its other side, image and money, image and debt, image and time, this is what we are going to try to think through. By turning around these several phrases from Gilles Deleuze that will constantly accompany us, lying in the background of each one of our gazes, we have already read part of the first sentence, I quote again, "Money, money is the backside of all the images that cinema shows and edits from the front, so that," Deleuze continues, "so that films about money are already, if implicitly, films within the film or about the film. This is the old curse which undermines cinema. Money is time." End of quote. Now, around these words gravitates in time image a constellation of filmmakers and films that each in their own way have attempted to stage this verso of filmic images, to thematize their monetary other side. Wim Wenders with The State of Things, 1982, Marcel L'Herbier with L'Argent, Money, 1928, and of course Robert Bresson, who in his last film, directed in 1983, also called L'Argent, Money, perhaps allows us to see the allegory par excellence of this fiduciary backdrop that hiding behind each cinematic image makes it possible. What then happens at the very beginning of L'Argent, of Money, by Bresson? Let me describe this beginning before showing it to you. You will see the door of an ATM closing and becoming the metallic background, sort of black screen, where a writing of light is traced out, where luminescent streaks pass by horizontally, reflections of car headlights passing on the street, and where the white letters of the credits are displayed. As if this open and then closed door of the ATM were the condition of possibility for all the images to come. The first shot, then, as you will see, shows a glass door that comes at an angle to another. A boy, Norbert, comes closer, knocks at the window, and opens the door. It's the beginning of the month, and he has come to ask his father for pocket money. The bills then pile up on the table, on the desk, as if for a moment we were seeing within the story, in other words, as we say in film studies, in the diegetic space, right? So as if we were seeing within the story the re-emergence of the fiduciary money that the initial closing of the ATM seemed to want to limit to the extra diegetic, outside the film, and as its condition of possibility. It will become clearer when I show you the clip. But when Norbert, the young boy, asks for more money because he has to reimburse a debt, it's also a story of a debt, contracted at his high school, then his father refuses, and we see the glass door of the office close, thus repeating the film's inaugural gesture, a door opening and closing. Now, let's watch now. I'm sorry because I don't have English subtitles for the French dialogues, but my excuse is that the dialogues, actually in all the clips that I will show to you, are not so important. Yes, okay. This is the very beginning of L'Argent by Bresson.
Prenez le premier, dis-moi. Et aussi, si tu veux bien, j'ai emprunté une petite somme au lycée, je dois la rendre.
Non, non.
Les parents de mes camarades leur donnent beaucoup plus.
Non, mais je te prie, ne laissez pas.
Now, we will have to wait for a long time for the image of the ATM door, that sort of preview image of l'argent, for this image to be truly taken up again and included in the story being told to us. In other words, for it to be fully integrated and justified in the diegesis, in the world of the narration. It is only after the trial and arrest of Yvon, another character, that we see Lucien, still another one, and his two accomplices in the midst of trafficking in credit cards. At that point, Bresson once again shows us the same metallic panel sliding open and closed, then the machine stopping and getting stuck, holding the card, whose code Lucien has made sure to memorize. When Lucien, using pliers, then recovers the card and puts it back into the ATM, the camera, as you will see, insists for a long time on the emission of the bills, 5 100-franc bills, the so-called Delacroix bills, because on their backside was the self-portrait of Eugène Delacroix, printed along with a detail from Liberty Guiding the People, the famous painting. So these 5 100-franc bills are ejected one after the other, like as many images, actually, come to reintroduce on the recto side of the film and in the world of its narration something that until then and since the opening credits had remained rather hidden in a backdrop or in a back world as what is presupposed behind every image. So this now comes back in the world of the film. Let me show you that credit card trafficking scene.
Ça va?
Non, mais j'ai déjà la carte d'école. Je l'ai bien vue. 3, 8, 7, 6. Mais si je laisse les deux lamelles là où je les avais mises, le truc est découvert. Il faut y renoncer pour toutes les autres machines et pour toujours.
So in Bresson's Money, L'Argent, money first appears as the background and foundation, so to speak, of every possible filmic image. And then, going from this transcendental foundation to the empirical level of the narrative, money is printed, it is cut up, it is distributed in the form of bills that are also themselves images, among others. Attempting to seize this money that seems to slide in between the images and go from the film to its outside and vice versa, this is the impossible task of Michel, the protagonist of Bresson's magnificent pickpocket, as we can see in the remarkable and rightly famous sequence of the train in the Gare de Lyon. Here it is, this wonderful sequence. Now what happened? Michel, as you saw, steps up into a train car whose corridor, as it passes between two parallel rows of windows that give respectively onto the outside and onto the inside of the compartments, this corridor seems to be a slide, right? A slide for a continuous procession or scrolling. Michel steals the wallet of a first passenger and hands it off to his accomplice, who is actually embodied on screen by a real pickpocket, Henri Cassagi, who was discovered by Bresson and who will later become a renowned magician and prestidigitator. Then a second accomplice takes over, and the wallet thus passes from hand to hand. It circulates, following the axis of the corridor, while the image of the pickpockets operating in a chain, the image is doubled in its reflection in the compartment windows. Then, when another victim passes through the narrow corridor, the bodies seem to have to submit themselves to a certain flattening, to facilitate the exchanges and their to and fro's. It was in fact Bresson himself who would often note his, I quote him, his obsession with flattening all images, like ironing, he said, as a way of facilitating the transactions or transformations between them. So filmed frontally from the inside of a compartment, Michel's torso, seen head-on, and that of his accomplice, seen from behind, these two torsos become like two sliding panels, like the two slide viewers that ensure the change of image within the lantern constituted by this glassed wagon, a lantern that is magical in more than one way. The victim's suit and tie torso seems to be pressed up against the plane of the screen. The interstice between his jacket and his shirt is crushed and becomes no more than the layering of two slivers between which one could slip a still or a slide. Let's watch this sequence again. Now, it is this very same thinly layered flatness of the passing of images that we find in so many other moments of Pickpocket, where the slide viewer, that infra-thin gap between the surface of the screen and itself, right? It can become maybe, for example, the fold of a newspaper, a piece of clothing that is half open, or a door that remains ajar. We might think in particular of the famous initial sequence at the Longchamp racetracks. Seen from behind, you will see, Michel is making his way toward the track and joins up with the crowd of spectators that the camera then films straight on, frontally, as if the better to flatten, again, to flatten them into a kind of fresco or to compress them into a bas-relief that occupies all of the foreground, in whose unthickness, so to speak, fingers weave in and out and banknotes, the image bills, circulate. At the moment when Michel is going to slide the money he has just taken from his neighbor's purse into his pocket, a man walks by, you will see, with a newspaper, making the paper money disappear as if through the effect of a wipe on the screen, as if the image were being erased. The money is thus, you will see, twice stolen. It is taken by the hand in the bag, and it is almost immediately erased from the surface of the screen by the wipe, the newspaper, that redoubles the theft. Let me show you that. you saw the money stolen twice, actually stolen from the purse and immediately wiped off the screen by this folded newspaper that creates the effect of a wipe, as you say in the language of film. Now, once we have noticed them, we see that folded newspapers are everywhere in Pickpocket, where they present as many opportunities for an image or a bit of an image to pass into or under one another, under another, to be exchanged for another, thanks to this folding of the visible that opens obscure transactions within it. Think, for example, of the metro sequence that I will show you, when Michel fascinatedly observes another pickpocket in action. You will hear his off-screen voice in French speaking of, I quote, a man behaving strangely, I couldn't get my eyes off of him. Then the newspaper, in this sequence too, serves first of all as a visual mask that provides a cover for the manual operation of extracting a wallet. This wallet is then transported, hidden in the folds of the newspaper, from which, thanks to a dissolve, it will re-emerge in another space and in other hands, no longer in the metro, but in Michel's bedroom, where we see him practicing the gestures he has just seen another perform. This is how the folded newspaper, in a way, becomes an allegory for the film's editing itself, as the passage from one shot to the next, situated elsewhere. Let me show you the metro sequence.
Pourquoi m'a-t-il fallu me trouver en face d'un homme au comportement étrange quand je ne pouvais détacher mes yeux? Comment le prendre? Avec quel droit? Vous savez bien que ça ne vient pas tout seul. La main tremblée, c'est trembler le journal.
Now, at Michel's place, in his room, it becomes clear that the folded newspaper, the piece of clothing yawning open, or the door that one leaves ajar are equivalent insofar as they are passages where the image bill can be slid in order to be stolen and exchanged. Thus, a bit later on, when Michel is practicing loosening a watch band on the leg of his table, we see him slide it between the base and mattress of his bed before getting up to go close the door with a delicate gesture of the index and middle fingers that is exactly identical to the gesture he makes to slide the jackets open. In an extremely fine shot that I will show you, Bresson then shows the door ajar, included in the shadow of the open jacket that Michel is in the midst of putting on.
doigt encercle le bracelet l'empêchant de pivoter. Pendant que le pouce délivre le cuir, elle fait sortir de la boue. Je m'y exerçais souvent. C'était dimanche. Jacques et moi avions projeté de sortir ensemble. Jeanne devait se joindre à nous.
You see, they strictly overlap the jacket and the door. The door ajar, the gaping garment, the gap between the mattress and the base, the folded newspaper, these are all interstices that introduce a slight layering into the projection surface, where a printed note, an image, can disappear and then re-emerge. Within the story, within the filmic diegesis, these openings, hollows, or folds remark the images that pass by, in other words, the meta-diegetic slide viewer that makes the film possible as such. It is as if in these cracks or crevices, the world of the film, the cine world, finally gaped open onto its other side, allowing its conditions of possibility to be glimpsed. Because what we could find on the verso of each image is probably nothing other than the principle of its interchangeability, in other words, its potential for circulation and its vocation for transaction, in short, its pure exchange value. Something Bresson is constantly insisting upon as constitutive of cinematography in what is most proper to it. Quote, an image's value must above all else be an exchange value, Bresson declares. And elsewhere, he notes, quote again, cinematographic film, where the images, like the words in a dictionary, have power and value only through their position and relation. End of quote. Or again, quote, no absolute value of an image. End of quote. Which thus seems to be, this image, it seems to be able to become a cinematographic image, only if, I quote Bresson again, it is taken so that it has mainly an exchange value. End of quote. Now, this is perhaps what Michel and the other pickpockets are attempting to grasp, literally, under the name or under the sign of money. Exchange as such, the always disappearing instant of pure exchange, which has to be nabbed, if it were possible, which has to be caught as it flies by in order to wrest it from the darkness where it is constantly plunging again. In sum, money would thus be the mark of the passage within the slide viewer. Money, you remember, money, Deleuze was saying in Time Image, is the backside of all the images that the cinema shows and edits from the front, so that films about money are already, if implicitly, films within the film or about the film. End of quote. This enigmatic sentence, at first sight at least, this sentence that we placed at the threshold of our reading of a few chosen sequences from Bresson, this sentence has constantly accompanied our gaze. With each glance at every view of a slide, it was there in the shadows, secretly guiding or looking over our viewing. Now Deleuze, taking up a formula that has become proverbial and whose origin is no doubt to be found deep in an immemorial antiquity, Deleuze added that, I quote him, what undermines cinema is the old curse, money is time. End of quote. The expression returns more than once in these pages of Time Image, occasionally being inverted to take on its most usual form, I quote Deleuze again, time is money, or the circulation of money. End of quote. Now, how shall we understand this statement that Deleuze turns one way or another by using its two sides in an equivalent way, exchanging its two sides, time is money or money is time? We could say that money, that for which perhaps money is the name in Bresson's work and perhaps in film in general, money is what from the outset virtualizes each image, stealthily moves and removes it, phenomenalizes or phantomizes it, turning it into a virtual image, an image that is never simply present, that is always ready to be substituted by another, including by a copy of itself. And this was precisely what the train car scene in the Gare de Lyon, in Pickpocket, made us think. A scene that I would like to show you for the third time for a very brief moment. Now, as you saw, and now for the third time, and the last, I promise, as you saw, the sequence is in effect structured along two axes. On the one hand, the axis of the corridor, where flattened travelers pass, carrying images that are also flat, and that circulate by sliding one after another through the slide viewers provided by the pieces of clothing equivalent to the folds in the newspapers, the doors gaping ajar, or the sliding glass panels of the compartments. And, on the other hand, you have the perpendicular axis of the compartments. So, on the glass surface of these compartments, each one of the images is immediately doubled as a reflection in a mirror. We see in particular the shimmering reflection of Michel's two accomplices. So the actual image that passes in front of its virtual double. Right? This is exactly what Deleuze, in the pages from Time Image, around which we are turning, this is what he called a crystal image. What does this mean? The crystal image, writes Deleuze, I quote, consists in the indivisible unity of an actual image and its virtual image. Now, notice the quotation marks around the possessive pronoun. These quotation marks, its virtual image, are the very mark of the image's virtualization. Now, this undivided unity of the image, actual and virtual, that nonetheless splits the image in two. So this crystal image, this unity of the crystal image, split in two, in actual and virtual, it is perhaps, at bottom, nothing other than the internal scission or division of the image between a use value and an exchange value. And this unity is described by Deleuze as a circuit. I quote from the Time Image, Deleuze, the actual image and its virtual image thus constitute the smallest internal circuit, ultimately a peak or a point, but a physical point which has distinct elements. So I would add a point that would thus paradoxically be divided. And Deleuze continues, distinct but indiscernible, such are the actual and the virtual, which are in continual exchange. End of quote. Now, if this is true, then in all rigor, one would have to say that it is already between the image and itself that there is exchange. In this circuit, in this circulation contracted into one point, where the image virtually becomes the equivalent of itself, in a kind of doubling in place that is precisely the condition of possibility of its swapping interchangeability with other images. Yet, as Deleuze writes about Bresson's L'argent, money, I quote, money, because it is of the order of time, money makes impossible any reparation for evil done, any equivalence or just retribution. End of quote. Here, I have to recall very briefly that in Anti-Oedipus, Deleuze and Guattari, very early on, insisted on the fact that economy should not be thought on the basis of exchange, but rather on the basis of debt. And that money, in their eyes, was first and foremost, I quote from Anti-Oedipus, the means for rendering the debt infinite. End of quote. It is thus, from the perspective of Anti-Oedipus, written 10 years before the two volumes on film, that one must understand what Deleuze says of the crystal image as dissymmetrical exchange. Time as money, or money as time in sum, is the debt impossible to reimburse that each image contracts on its invisible other side, inaccessible from the cine world of the diegesis. Let us look one last time at the end of the episode of The Sopranos that we started with, for all debts, public and private, where the photographic image is turned over, money is inscribed facing time, and the fiduciary note or bill seems to look us in the eyes. Here. The gaze addressed to us from that $20 bill, this gaze seems cross-eyed. It seems to be cross-eyed, we were saying. It is affected, seemingly, by a divergent strabismus, right? It seems to stare at us perpendicularly to the screen with its right eye. And with its left eye, it seems to want to look elsewhere, perhaps into the very plane of the screen, in its both layered and flat thickness, where images go by one after the other as the views pass through the slide viewer. Now, this strabismus would then perhaps be the crystalline circulation of a dissymmetrical exchange within the filmic gaze itself, between the two eyes, the one turned toward the actual and the other toward the virtual. And if they diverge, it is because, to quote Deleuze one last time, in the infernal circuit between image and money, there is this inflation which time puts into the exchange. End of quote. Time or debt money, I will talk a lot about debt and time and exchange in the next lecture, time or debt money is what makes the eyes on the bill image cross. Thank you very much.